Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters Radio.
Well, good morning. Here we are for another edition of Growth Matters Radio, where we talk about all things growth. And today we have two individuals that have a long history together and a very successful career in the field of environmental engineering. And so with us, we have the principals and co-founders of Corporate Environmental Risk Management, or I guess sometimes use the acronym CERM. And we have Al Edwards. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Marcus Reith.
Good morning.
Great. So we are going to talk about that field and a little bit about what you do. So even before we get started to know a little bit more about each of you, explain to our listening audience sort of what is environmental engineering just as sort of a practice in a field.
Yeah, you know, environmental engineering is relatively young as a, you know, as a standalone discipline. It's a branch of civil engineering. And it's largely about air, water, and land protection and preservation.
Okay. All good good things I like.
Yeah.
I like air to breathe and having a place to
a little
be.
Water, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Great. So why don't you tell us, I'll start with you, Marcus. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this, and maybe a little bit about how you know this guy next to you, Al.
It's a long history there. Well, back in high school, I was in a program that I worked at the Corps of Engineers as a student aide that introduced me to engineering. And from there, I decided to go to Tuskegee for mechanical engineering. And at the time that I graduated, environmental was a popping field. So even though I had an mechanical engineering degree, I was hired to do environmental stuff.
Okay.
So that's how my career got started.
Okay. And how do you and Al have a long history together?
Yeah, we go back to high school.
Great.
Yeah,
so friends out of high school.
Yes.
And then Al, maybe as you tell us your background, then help us understand how you then transitioned that to decide you could be partners.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We met in high school, actually the summer program. A city councilman took us basically to the Corps of Engineers as part of a summer internship program. They were being sued at the time for some of their historic hiring practices, and that's where we were exposed. So I subsequently, Marcus went on to Tuskegee. I went to Mississippi Valley, and I majored in football. And I, but got a minor in industrial engineering. Actually, I had a major in industrial engineering, a minor in math and computer science, and did a little military ROTC as well. You know, it was $100 a month back then, and that was
I was middle class on campus, you know.
Right. So.
Yeah, well, great. So then how did you come together sort of, you know, a lot of people know each other, but they don't necessarily start a company
together. It's something that's prophetic about, you know, speaking things. You know, we had our little business cards when we were in high school, and we envisioned having some sort of business. And so we kind of went in our separate ways. But my family situation, I probably ate more food at Marcus's mom's house in the last 30 years than he has. So we kind of developed a kinship at that level, and we remained in touch. And so we finished school around the same time. And so I actually went to work for a firm, a local engineering firm. We were referred by some people at the Corps. And Marcus, you know, joined the firm, and then he went to California. I went to Chicago, made my way here to Atlanta, and subsequently, I, you know, went back to school, got a master's in business, and started to work in corporate and Equitable. And Marcus had applied for a position at the same company, coincidentally, and he was the top guy. And so we ended up working together, you know, straight out the neighborhood, and here we are on Peachtree. you know, watching the parade from our offices and so forth, and you know, working at Equitable Real Estate.
Great. That's a great, great history. So, Marcus, share with us a little secret here. What's the key to friends being able to actually start a business together? Because, you know, there's a lot of friendships that maybe think they can do that, but it doesn't quite work. So what makes it work for the both of you, Marcus?
I think having similar goals, you know, want to help in the community, want to do good things, want some level of success, have a family, so want to see great things for them and introduce them to the engineering field, the science.
Great.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think our values, kind of echo, you know, we say similar goals, but then even beyond that, the values, you know, I think we have a deep-seated trust, you know, and so that, because you start reading some of the standards about choosing partners, and you really need to know all these things about a person, but it has to fundamentally come back to trust.
Yeah.
And so luckily we had that history, and that, you know, it went through enough, you know, earlier in life, and remain connected through our families, where it just seemed like the natural thing to do.
So our listeners are always interested in people that have, you know, sort of made that transition from another business, corporate America or the government or, you know, wherever they sort of start their careers, into being an entrepreneur and starting a business. So when did you know that you were an entrepreneur?
You know, that's a really good question. Because we were having a good time in corporate. The people were very, very nice to us, very kind. They made sure we had resources, and considering our backgrounds, when we got in their environment, we were competitive. We wanted to do the best we could. You know, we started to appreciate what had happened in our lives, you know. And really, what really triggered us, we would go to our separate conferences and then ask questions and find ourselves speaking at conferences, and people start to ask us about helping them with certain things. And we would help, basically just helping in a volunteer sense. And before we knew it, you know, the help pile had gotten to be the size of the work pile. Okay. So we had an incident, but at the time I was dating a young lady. Her son had sickle cell, and I had a young nephew. He was diagnosed, and I was trying to, and so they were having an annual dinner, and I wanted to get them to buy a table, my company to buy a table. And I approached folks, the leaders of the company in the marketing area, and they offered to buy two tickets. Two tickets were $200. When the folks from New York came down for a closing or something, the first bottle of wine was $200. So, mm-hmm. And they weren't bad people, but, you know, in business school, you just understand that people, their social programming and the way they spend their social dollars is normally aligned with their strategic planning. So they just had not had, and they were not bad people at all. Great, we still have good relationships with them. And so subsequently, we figured out if we want to be able to buy tables and, you know, sponsor Little League football and have shadowing programs, you know, that we have to have a company. And so we were probably young enough and foolish enough not to understand the risk that we were taking on. So
yeah, that's always a part of it, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So that, but that's kind of what happened. We wanted to be able to do more in the community, as Marcus said.
And for me, it probably started much younger. I was actually selling candy in second grade.
Wow.
Cutting grass, things of that sort.
So you always had an entrepreneurial spirit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think it probably came from my grandmother.
Yeah.
She did a lot of coaching when I was young.
Great. Great. So talk to us a little bit about CRM. Tell us a little bit, Marcus, about what it is you all do in your consulting, and we'll learn a little bit about the type of projects that you work on.
Well, we do in program management, you know, school programs, managing the new construction. We do environmental cleanup project, which include asbestos and lead. We do survey and boundary surveys, topo surveys. Most of our work is related to new construction or renovation projects as such, and demolition. What am I missing?
He has trained me to be the elevator guy. So
give us that great elevator.
Yeah, there it is. I teed it up, right? Yeah. So we're an environmental engineering and program management firm, and so we provide technical and program management services to corporate, to governmental, transportation, and education clients. So we're organized by five business groups. We have an environmental group, a engineering group, surveying, remediation and contracting, and a program management group. So we're approaching about 45 people now.
Right.
So
okay. So it's my understanding when you started out, you were founded in 1995. It was the two of you and maybe one other employee, and you know, many of our listeners out there are budding entrepreneurs, people that are focused on how they start and grow a business. And so we're always curious, how did you sort of make that transition from there's three people and we're working on some number of projects to this idea of now being able to grow to in that 45 employee sort of range? What was sort of the genesis that allowed you to be able to do that?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I said initially when we first started, we was in corporate, and corporate had decided to, I guess, downsize or sell that branch of the business, and we was able to convince the new owners to outsource the function that we was doing. So we actually got started with the client, which is, makes it a lot easier and takes some of the risk off of it.
And then how did you grow from that first client to multiple clients?
Yeah, it's probably just the fundamentals. You know, we started off with a business plan, and you know, we had some ideas about the market that we wanted to do business in, and found out the cost of fully entering that market, that corporate sector where we were, it was going to, you know, and our services hadn't evolved in the market. So the services were kind of in the introductory stage. And so we became aware that our skill set was could be utilized, you know, transportation and government projects. And so our first big public project was the environmental impact statement at Hartsfield, and it was a 2-year, $5 million study, and we conducted about $800,000 of that work. I mean, with environmental justice, hazardous materials, water resources, cultural resources. And so that kind of gave us the baseline to grow the business and then to start to explore other markets.
So how did you position yourself to be a part of that study? Can you think back to that time when you were going after that and maybe not having all the relationships that you do now that positioned you?
Yeah, you know, I'm a break from the textbook and say it was just really grace. The client, you know, the client actually, the local folk at the city, they wanted another team. The FAA wanted the team that we were a part of, and the FAA were going to provide technical leadership on the project. And so that's how we won that. And then over the course of the years, you know, you have tough periods, and we always say that whatever we do, we try and do what we think is the right thing to do at the time, even if it's a little unconventional. And so that has always given us momentum with, you know, early on when there are payrolls, you know, and you got families and here it comes, and God, it's going to be Friday, what we're going to do, and then the check shows up Thursday.
Yeah.
Or wire comes in.
Yeah.
So
all budding entrepreneurs and even long-term entrepreneurs, you know that feeling. And I appreciate you with that moving from the textbook answer, because I think a lot of times our listeners and young entrepreneurs or people that think they want to do it, they look and they see people that have been successful. And because you're not a part of that or you're not in their heads, a lot of people think it's because they are doing all the right things. I don't think I can do that. But it's a balance between what you do and being in the right place at the right time.
Exactly.
And relationships and those kinds of things. So all of those things kind of play in, and as an entrepreneur, you have to be sort of open that things will evolve and emerge. You can't, it's not always a cookie cutter textbook kind of experience.
Exactly. And having a good relationship with a bank, that was probably the toughest getting started, you know.
So how did you build that relationship?
It was a local bank.
Citizens Trust. They were First Southern at the time. I think our first line of credit may have been $1,500 or something like that.
I think
that.
It was 30.
It was $30.
$30,000,
yes. Yeah, but they've been partners with us, and you know, as you kind of build your advisory team, you need people with other, you know, they say that if business is a 360-degree circle, you know, what you do is only about 90 degrees of it, or 25%. So you got to build these other skill sets.
Right.
And so we found at the incubator, for example, there were people there who really kind of helped us get oriented and then help you understand what you don't know.
So the incubator, tell our listeners a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
Was it a specific one that you...
It was the SoftaCal Business Incubator. We were basically funded by block grants and so forth. I mean, the idea was to try and promote those businesses that had innovations. Some of the more popular incubators would be maybe Georgia Tech's. You know, they produce MindSprings and a number of other technology companies. But we got started out in South DeKalb. We were next to Kroger's on Rainbow Drive. and learn how to fight, fight termites, flying termites, that kind of thing. But it was a good time. So many of the businesses of that time today have survived, and they're doing well and contributing to the community.
Great. So talk to us a little bit about a project. What's the an issue that you're trying to solve? You gave kind of what your products and your services are, but sort of bring to life for our listeners maybe a current project or a past project and what you actually do for them.
Yeah, the one that may be the most dynamic, I guess. I was thinking Mobile Gas. What were you thinking?
That's a good one.
Yeah, Mobile Gas. This is a former manufactured gas plant, and before we electrified regions and had electricity the way we have it today, utility companies would gasify coal. And they would burn it and pipe it and use a fan system and or either water and oil system to kind of fan it. It's almost like throwing water on a barbecue pit, and you get this gust of air. Well, they would have those operations, and that's how they lit the cities. Well, the byproduct of those operations were like a tar material, and in those tars it has a number of chemicals of concern, solvents, metals such as lead and arsenic, things of that nature. And there were 1,500 of these sites around the country. And so as electricity came online, these sites were oftentimes conveyed to municipalities. And this was in the 1930s and 40s. This was starting back in the 1800s. And so municipalities were sitting there with this land. And so when the 1960s came along, HUD came along. And they had this ability to go get money from the federal government to start, to build housing. And they would build housing in proximity to these sites, and I don't think it was a draconian plot or anything. Mm-hmm. I think our transportation system wasn't as evolved at that time, and so it wasn't unconventional to build housing in industrial areas. And so subsequently, now the environmental regulations came online in the 70s, and then the 80s, and so all of a sudden we find out that people are living around these hazardous facilities. So our client, they own this property in Mobile, and they were actually sued by the NAACP back in probably around 2000. And we were hired by the city to do a comparative analysis. We went out to Seattle because they wanted to make the place a park. And we advised the city, and we gave our recommendations. And I think the recommendation stung our existing client a little bit. But I think after the sting wore off, they invited us in. And so what we've done, we had to build what we call a community mitigation plan. Because the idea is to, it was an environmental justice issue, and the idea was to bring benefit to people who had been burdened. And so we have like an environment, we built an environment, we have a technical advisory group and a community advisory group. And this is probably a $7 or $8 million project after the remediation is done. And with these groups, we involved people from the community who had a vested interest in the site and in the community. And our goals, the mitigations, were we want to develop educational partnerships to make sure that the money that we use to clean this site up is going to enhance education. We wanted to enhance workforce development by job creation. And also, we want to have small businesses involved. And so, like, we have an environmental education program, and we're – so it's kind of probably a longer story than you wanted to hear.
That's okay. Mm-hmm.
But what we're doing, we said that we have responsibility. We were exposed early, and we understand the power of exposure early. And so we say, let's produce some scientists and engineers from this community. So the client, and we've had to move the client from their place of being very conservative to say, it's okay to do an environmental education program for this elementary and middle school. Because we'll and have a 10-year commitment around it, because we're going to produce some engineers.
So Marcus, it seems like if that particular example is one that you either replicate or you have similar things, you're kind of people think or no not people. When I think of engineering, I'm not sure I think of engineering and then also having these type of projects. So how do you sort of do that dance and balance so that you're not only addressing sort of the technical pieces of things, but it sounds very much like there's a social component?
It is. And one of the projects I will mention is some of the engineering work we do when it comes to, like, the runway. We're doing soil testing, concrete testing, testing the soil to ensure that it can support the facility that they're trying to build there. We do a lot of work with the school system when there's mold issues or asbestos-related issues, and you got teachers and students and parents that's really concerned. So those projects are more high profile somewhat, and we get involved with that and help the school system explain to the parents and to the teachers what's going on and what we can do to mitigate those issues.
Yeah, it does sound like you walk a line where you are hired by an entity.
The owner.
And sometimes the news that you have to deliver on what the right thing is maybe more expensive than what they thought, or it's going to take in another direction. How do you sort of walk that line and create that balance so that the project itself can move forward, but that, as you said, there's also good surrounding it?
Well, I mean, we think that kind of goes back to what we've kind of inherited as a strategic blessing. I mean, it's kind of non-textbook, but what we do is we try and help the client to achieve their goals. And in many cases, entities have to be, you know, they have to get out of their own way. I mean, our clients in Mobile, I mean, it's like, you guys are in the business of selling gas. And so, you know, you need to have good, healthy relationships with the community and not have a legal or lawyer-driven mindset as to how you're going to address these projects. You have opportunities to do that. And so we try and understand what the client is trying to do. That's kind of our core competence. What they're trying to do, and coincidentally, as a, you know, community folk, I mean, and having, you know, come from the community, so to speak, that's just a soft skill that we've always had, and we've found it at this point in life that it has been an additive to the business, and in some cases, a distinguishing feature of our business.
Sure, so. I was looking at a little bit of write up, and I saw this idea of, you know, the clients are at the center of every project. And so I'm curious, Mark, as you have grown, how have you ensured that your employees, and I'm sure you all also have partners that you work with, are able to keep the client at the center? I mean, is there one or two little tips you can maybe share with our audience that ensures that kind of consistency about client focus is in every project?
Well, you really have to reiterate it to the employees. I mean, because we're up to 45 people now and employees, and so you always have new ones coming in. It's something you just have to keep reiterating on what our goals are. It ain't always the profit that we can make on it. It's really talk to the client and make sure you understand, because we get calls all the time, and the regulation says we need this, but you really need to talk to it to understand what they are trying to accomplish.
You talk about regulations. How do you keep up with the trends and the issues that impact your ability to provide good counsel and recommendations to your clients?
Yeah, we have an unbelievable team. I mean, we have some subject matter experts in each of the areas where we work, where it's kind of like the restaurant concept. I mean, the restaurant can look really good. It could, the environment could be nice, but if the food isn't good, folk aren't coming back. And so that's kind of the driver. And so in many cases, in each of those business groups, we have a model. We encourage people professional development. We like people to document what they're doing, what they want to do in the following year. And we challenge them. We challenge them to get outside of the walls and be involved in, you know, best practices. And so in addition to the, you know, the periodicals, but you're out there observing the environment and you see what's going on in practice, what's relevant. So
yeah, I was with a group of other CEO women on Monday of this week, and one of the things that was being talked about is how critical in a service consulting environment the people are. And so what you started that explanation with, we have great people, and Marcus, you sort of shook your head on that. So Marcus, what's sort of, again, any tips you can give to our listening audience, because finding good people that align with your culture, have the skills, is not just, you know, something that sometimes is a walk in the park. What do you do specifically in the recruiting process to make sure that you get a good match with those that are part of your business?
Oh, good question. I think having a good environment that people work in, it ain't so high pressure. It's more of a family environment. We do have always out working, and you're always running into people that works for other firms and others. So you're kind of always looking for people, even though you may not be looking for someone at a particular time, but you kind of tag them as you go. And if you need someone in that arena, you kind of reach back out and see if they. It's just a lot of people that works with big firms that kind of look forward to coming to a smaller firm because I think of the environment that we have.
Yeah, we've had employees to leave and come back.
Right.
So employees are pretty powerful actually in helping you to, you know, we kind of have a set of values we think are important, you know, beyond the skill set. And so our HR person, she screens for those values. But then we get the employee, what we've learned, we kind of have to get out of the way. I mean, our employees, they can say, yeah, you know, no, that's no, I don't think it's going to work. So the idea is to give them the tools and get them involved. And they normally, you know, and they're the best recruiters, too.
Exactly.
I mean, when they bring people forward, normally
they're solid.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you talked about getting out of your own way. So now let's shift a little bit to kind of the personal. You know, what's something that, Al, you've learned as being, you know, a principal in a business and growing a business about yourself personally that has maybe been a surprise, surprise to you?
Yeah, that's a great question because I was at a retreat last week. We're in a mentor protege program with MARTA through GMSDC in the state, and you know you go to these courses and you say okay, you know they want to train us again, that kind of thing, and I always appreciate training, and so I go and I was sitting there listening, and what I found is. You know, I want to improve my leadership skills. I mean, the easy part is to say, yeah, I have that down. But you know, you have to really look at what results you're achieving, what results you're not achieving, and say, okay, maybe I need to slow this thing down a little bit and become a little more qualitative in the way I think about things, the way I engage our people, the way I engage clients, that kind of. And that stuff that's important for home too. So,
Marcus, what's sort of a lesson that you've taken away as a result of being a leader?
I think patience. I think I've learned that. Yeah, and I continue to work on that. And my work ethics. I find myself working into the wee hours too many nights of the week.
Yeah. And as an entrepreneur, the work. You know, people think sometimes, oh, you do that, and then you have a lot of free time to do other things. But most entrepreneurs, they really love working in the business. And so kind of with that, I'll go back to the reference of being with some CEO women on Monday. How do you ensure that you have the right balance of working on your business so that it continues to grow and, you know, you seek new heights, and working in the business with clients and the specific things that you have to do to make sure that the projects get done on time and that kind of thing. It's a tough balance sometimes, Al. You know, so how do you kind of arrange your day and your role to be able to do both?
Yeah, there are some things such as like in having an office in Mobile. I mean, I have to actually kind of section off time that I'm devoting to the Mobile office while I'm sitting in Atlanta. They're the corporate management functions, the business management functions, so we have to block off time. And so normally we get a lot of that done on Mondays. And so those milestones keep us coming back to look at how are we actually performing. But the other part is, you know, we're kind of passionate about what we get to do. We get to do a lot of good stuff, so a lot of good projects, involved with, see people grow, see families come together, those type things. But to answer your question, that's how I do it. I have to do it from a scheduling standpoint, and I just kind of, and I have to try and stay true to the discipline of following, you know, protecting certain times in the week to do certain things.
Marcus, is that the approach you use, or do you have a different?
I would probably put that at one of the top challenges that I have. I tend to try to service everybody during the day. And so when it's time to do my things, it's already 7 o'clock at night. So I find myself not doing very well in that arena. And I'm working on that.
And working on that. Yeah, well, we all have things that we, you know, we need to grow and we need
but
to work
but
on.
But he's a natural leader, though. I mean, the people are kind of, they come to him to kind of, if my somewhat static directions aren't clear, I think he ends up being the person who interprets what's Al thinking about today. So it's a good thing. It's a good balance.
Yeah, it kind of brings the balance for each of you. You help each other. What I wanted to also make sure that we touched on is this whole idea of minorities in STEM disciplines. For our listening audience, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. Mm-hmm. And it is certainly an area in our K through 12 that is receiving a lot of focus, and certainly in higher ed. So, you know, maybe if we – I tee this up as, you know, for either parents who have children – that they'd like to make sure they are at least exposed to things in those disciplines, or for our listeners that are making decisions, because you do a lot in the community. So talk to us a little bit about sort of the STEM discipline, particularly to engineering, and what kind of advice would you give to somebody, Marcus, that, you know, is interested or is not sure if they'd be a good fit in this discipline?
Well, we do have a mentoring program to where we reach out to, or they reach out to us, and we invite them in, and because we have about five disciplines that we can share with them over the course of a day, and on occasion maybe even take them out to the field, let them see what's involved with those disciplines.
How do you source the people that come to Shadow?
Yeah, it's really word of mouth. I mean, and but people know. I mean, and we. It's something we're really proud of, too, because we've seen young people, you know, who start off at middle school and then high school and basketball players. Oh, I'm a, well, you know, Mr. Marcus, Mr. Al, I think I want to major in civil engineering. And they, you know, they're Georgia Tech and they finish. And, you know, and you got MBA. Okay, I'm going to go get MBA. And so, and now they're looking at our business plan saying, you know, we really should be thinking internationally. Those same kids that, you know, that's the power of it. I think that it's really a social responsibility, and it's kind of an inferred expectation of small businesses that when you work on projects that you partner with educational entities. For us, you know, coming from high school, our exposures, I mean, it changed the direction of our lives and the lives of our families. And so we feel like it's something that's true we need to stay true to. And so by exposing kids, it basically, I think it enhances their academic experience. It enhances their decision making. You know, once you know about what you want to do, you start to figure out what you can't do. And so, and therefore, you know, you have to decide if you're going to keep rolling with your boys who are doing this, or no, I don't know if Mr. Mark is going to approve that. And I don't think I'll be able to continue to do this thing that I think I might have an opportunity in and to have the kind of life that they have.
So to be a little bit more specific for our listeners, you have the shadowing program and you know, in a given year, in a given year, sort of how many people come through it, and is it something that is multiple experiences, or is it typically, you know, a student comes in, as you said, they shadow you for a day, and then it's the experience.
And we generally the program is really built on the level of energy they give us. Some kids will come for one day, and they'll have we have a structured day, and normally we make sure that they get to do something external. If they're going to a fundraiser or go to an executive committee meeting at the chamber, but something external to give them a perspective outside of the day-to-day and the discipline areas of what we do. And then some of the kids, they want to come back the next day, and we say, well, just come on.
Right.
And so, and then they'll come, and then before you know it, they've bonded with somebody at the staff level.
Right.
And then I find out later, you know, because we're historically used to being at the center of everything. We find out that Mr. Jimmy has already given DJ a referral, and he started with a company in Marietta. And I was like, whoa, when did that happen? It's okay not to know everything.
Right.
So,
right.
And then we have an internship program which is geared toward juniors and seniors in college.
Okay.
Right. So, and they may spend a summer a little bit longer.
Yeah. So roughly how many kids have you touched? I didn't ask you to come with statistics, but I'm just interested. It sounds like it's a great program.
Yeah. It's been dozens. You know, we, you know, Mark, you know, family stuff is important. Mark is, you know, he cooks for his kids in the morning, all that kind of stuff. And so the kids in the company, you know, we try and create an environment where we feel okay with, you know, mothers bringing their son or daughter to work with them on the days like a bad weather day or something, or a teacher work day. It has, you know, I know as for large companies it's a bigger challenge, but it's been dozens.
Yeah.
I can't.
Dozens. It's a new program for us as well. So, and I know.
To call it a program, but it's just right. Something we've been doing.
It's part of your DNA.
Yeah, because you took 30 kids out during the airport project, I believe.
Yeah,
busload of them.
We took busloads of kids to the airport, to Atlantic Station. And some of those kids come full circle.
Right.
And some of them go running and screaming like, look, we don't want to do that.
Well, you know, sometimes the best experience is to understand what you don't want to do so that you can figure out what you do want to do. So for that, as I said, some advice. If you were going to give, you know, a potential student a piece of advice that would make it easier for them to embark upon a career in engineering. You know, what if I forced you to just pick one thing from each of you? What would be the thing, Al, that you would say that would most help them start a career in engineering?
Love of learning. Love of learning. I mean, just enjoying learn to enjoy learning. I mean, and however that comes to you, if it's, you know, if it's textbook, if it's in the community, but just have a passion for learning. Because it's just an ongoing thing, and find that engineering just happened to be the best vehicle for that mindset.
And good in math and science, of course.
Those are all very good. So I know that you all are also involved in the community. So you've talked a little bit about what you do to kind of help the next generation. Al, I think you're involved in the DeKalb Chamber. So talk to us a little bit more about what CERM does, you know, sort of in the community to support what's happening in DeKalb.
Well, part of our employee performance metrics is to encourage people to be involved. We think that the whole community involvement experience helps us to see ourselves and hopefully discover a blind spot that will help you professionally and personally. We've been involved with the chamber probably for about 5 years. I served on a committee, I chaired a committee, became a board member, and so now I'm the vice chair, so I'll be the 2015 chair-elect.
Congratulations.
And it's an honor. I mean, coincidentally, it'll be 20 years to the date next year that we started our business in South DeKalb. So the community has been very generous to us, and so we want to, you know, have an opportunity to give back in a more scale sense. And then I'm a trustee at Georgia Piedmont Technical College, and so I serve on the foundation board there. Where, personally, I didn't know much about technical colleges. I went to an event. The chairman gave this unbelievable prayer. When I woke up, I was a member of the church. but technical college, I mean, Georgia Piedmont, we're the fastest growing technical college in the state system. We grew 17%, and we're headquartered right there in Clarkston. We have 9 campuses that spread out 4 counties, and so we touch 20,000, you know, students. And I think when we think about workforce development, when we think about quality of life, our superintendent Michael Thurman talks about parental involvement, and the best way, one of the best ways to help parents get involved is to help them get a job. And so the technical college serves as a very important partner in that sense. I mean, and so it's kind of a jewel in the neighborhood that I personally didn't know about, but now I get a chance to serve on the executive committee, and that's a lot of fun.
Marcus, what kind of things are you involved in the community?
Well, I got married late, and we had 3 kids in a matter of a range of about 4 years, and one of my goals was always being a great father, and that has sucked up a whole lot of my time between running a business and raising a family. So I got some work to do there.
Yeah.
My oldest now is 17.
Oh, good.
And the youngest is 12. So I look forward to, you know, getting out more and doing more of these things. I think I'll be joining the YMCA board here soon.
Okay.
Yeah, South DeKalb. Yeah, and it's a balanced thing. Marcus focuses. We just hired an operations manager maybe 6-8 months ago to help us out. And Marcus really focuses on the operations, and I have probably more external responsibilities.
Right.
Yeah, so you balance each other.
That's the idea.
So as you think about the next 12 to 18 months at CERM, you know, what's sort of your biggest strategic challenge? What's the thing that you're going to be working on to ensure that for another 20 years you all are going to be around?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mark, you want to take the first cut at that? I had some things, but why don't you go
Well,
ahead?
You know, we've actually have several projects in pipeline that is going to require us to hire more people, buy more trucks, buy more equipment. So I think just managing the financial resources of the company and being in a position to acquire those things at the right time.
Managing the cash flow and the resources to make sure that you have the capacity and the capability to do the various projects that you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yep, cash is king.
And cash is king.
Yeah, and our backlog, so we've been able to grow the backlog of the business some. And so we find ourselves, you know, I mean, trying to be a little more strategic. We want to balance our portfolio a little more. The idea is not to have an over-concentration of any particular client. Are disciplined greater than 30%. So we're looking into some sectors where we think there's opportunities and we just haven't given it the energy that it deserves.
Yeah.
So we're looking, you know, at utility, private utilities. We're looking at DLT and maybe some of the federal work. So
on a yearly or an annual basis, or even thinking about sort of the long term, your point that each of you made, you know, sort of what I took away is, one challenge is you've got to balance what you're doing now and what you already have and make sure you have the right resources to be able to do that.
Right.
And then, like any good company, you've got to be thinking longer term and thinking about, am I growing in new markets? Am I doing new and different things?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you sort of formulate those plans? Is that something on an annual basis you're doing?
Yes.
Planning that's you know, a retreat,
yeah,
or together? How do you
annual business plan, you know? And we, you know, try, and we really try in the whole SWOT part of that, we try and dig into our weaknesses. You know, it's, you know, the strength discussion is always exciting, but then we have to kind of honestly try and assess where we're weak. And so we're trying over the course of the year, we're trying to find out where we need to. And so we've been able, like now we're converting our accounting system. That was one of our weaknesses. And so Marcus has been leading that project. We're probably 90% in.
Yes.
And there's just some other. So it's an annual planning. And then also we have some subcommittees where we give some of our young leaders an opportunity to lead. So we have an R&D committee. We have a document retention committee. We have a health and safety committee. Things that are very relevant to the operation, but they don't quite fit into any department per se, but need to be, you know. So it gives them an opportunity to lead, and they kind of bring best practices in those areas. So.
Yeah. So as you look out, you know, 5 years from now, if I were to invite you back, at, you know, kind of where is it that you would hope CRM would be? I heard you mention something about international. I don't know if that's on the radar, but, you know, tell our listening audience a little bit about sort of that vision in action that you're trying to do around growth and where you're taking the company.
Yeah, we're thinking, I mean, we've always thought that, you know, there's a regional, we want to really build the business around the Southeast, and I think we're going to be evaluating some international opportunities in Africa and the Caribbean. But we think there's plenty of business here at home. I mean, even in the 3-hour radius of Atlanta, there's communities that need, they're going to be making investments in infrastructure. I mean, we're going to continue to look at energy, and they need partners who can kind of help them convert, create jobs in their communities and address some of those mitigation issues that we talked about earlier. So
yeah, and I was remiss at the beginning of the hours. You were talking a little bit about the business. So you have an office in Alabama. You have one here in Atlanta. And so are those the primary geographies where most of your work is? Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we kind of view Mobile as kind of our Gulf region. You know, so we've done work in Mississippi. We've done work in Louisiana,
Florida,
and so Mobile. You know, the 3-hour radius in Mobile kind of covers a lot. It takes you into New Orleans. You're approaching Houston, and you're well into Mississippi, into Jackson, and things like that. So, and then of course we stage Atlanta here. You know, in 3 hours outside of Atlanta.
So. Great. Well, it has been really a great morning and learning about. A little bit more about environmental engineering and your company. Why don't we make sure that our listening audience knows how to reach you? So share a little bit about how they might contact you if they have questions.
Sure. Our website is CERM.com. And our Atlanta number is 678-999-0173.
And would that be the place that if a listener that is also like that idea of shadowing, they can contact, call the number, or they can go to the website?
That's right. Just reach out to us, and we'll facilitate it.
Yeah, either the website or the number.
Great. So it's time for me to ask the question that I ask all of the listeners that sit in the seats that you're listening. So you've given us a great perspective of things that are really important to you, both from a business and a professional standpoint. I mean, personal sort of thing that's driving your leadership. Think back to your 20-year-old self. And if you were going to talk to your 20-year-old self today and give them one piece of advice, what would you tell your 20-year-old self?
That's not a fair question.
Which, you know what? I'm turning to my producer. Last week, do you know that one of the people in the chair asked me, and I was put on the spot and had to answer.
Really? Yeah. What did you answer?
I talked about how you could be, you didn't realize that you could be as resilient as you're not always sure that you can kind of go through the valley. But you have a lot more resilience than you think you do when you're tested, and that's something I learned.
I love it. Yeah. All right, spotlight's back on you guys.
Yeah, my one word would be faith. Just truly believe that whatever vision has been given to you is authentic, and that very little happens by coincidence. You know, people, you go to networking events sometimes. You know, people want to meet the speaker or whatever. And I've come to believe that a lot of times he puts the person right next to me that I need to know. And maybe they're not famous or popular or even successful at that point, but it's just and that's what I've just learned. It's the faith piece. Just trust your vision, and even if it's unconventional, go with it and be passionate about it.
Yeah.
Focus.
So why focus? What?
At age 20, I probably needed to be a little bit more focused on what I was planning on doing for the rest of my life. Okay. At 20, I was at Tuskegee, and I was new.
And you were having a good time.
And I was having a good time.
Yeah. But that also shows that you can do that, and as you realize what you need to be focused on, you can still have great dreams and great things that focus. And when you said that, I'll take a little bit of privilege here as the person that heads Growth Matters. Just so yesterday was my father's birthday. He's deceased, but he came from the West Indies. He didn't get here until he was 34. He then went to put himself through college 3 years and then went to dental school. So Howard, D.C. is where I'm from.
Okay.
And so, the lesson that I've always took from him is that he didn't get here until he was 34. And we hear he did different things when he was, before he got here. But, it's never too late.
Right.
If you make a decision kind of what you talked about, your faith piece, and you focus, whenever that focus is, you're able to be very successful. So people that met him who saw him as a successful dentist just sort of thought he had done that all his life. So I don't sort of know how I got here other than, sort of acknowledging the path that he has laid for me at a time when it's kind of reminding me of the things that he's accomplished, but sort of that faith and that focus kind of, I think, brought that to mind this morning. So thank you for allowing me to be able to say that.
Well, he was obviously very committed. I mean, and that faith commitment, you know, and when with commitment, the things that you need, they start to show up. As a matter of fact, you find that they were already there.
Yeah.
So we appreciate you sharing.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for coming in to our Growth Matters show today. For our listening audience, I know you've gotten some good insights. Join us next week here at 10 o'clock when we will talk about all things growth, because growth matters.